I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the outstanding American Jewish historian, Deborah Lipstadt, author of the new book, The Eichmann Trial. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. My wife Wendy and I just returned from a trip to Europe where we had a variety of interesting and exciting Jewish experiences. It's good to be back home. And over the next couple of weeks, I'll share some of those stories with you here on Two Jewish. We went to Shabbat services afloat and at historic synagogues in two different countries and learned of ancient synagogues at some of the great cities of antiquity, which are now astounding archaeological sites. But one of the most interesting and surprising Jewish experiences I had took place during a very pleasant conversation with a guy on our cruise ship while we waited in line for a small tender boat ticket to go ashore at Santorini, Greece. He and his family live in Connecticut and travel a great deal. This guy had recently returned from a special middle school trip with his 12-year-old son on a secular humanitarian mission to the Amazon River region of Brazil. They had installed water treatment equipment there to lower the incidence of cholera and other dangerous waterborne diseases among the natives. In the course of this extraordinary trip, they had flown so low over the Andes in an unpressurized plane that they could reach out and touch clouds. They had gone whitewater rafting on Class 3 rapids in the Amazon River. They had free-floated in waters that included piranha and caimans, South American crocodiles. They'd leaped from rocky cliffs over waterfalls into tiny pools of water below, avoided snakes, both poisonous and constricting, and saw spiders the size of their own hands, and generally had a spectacular, if at times harrowing, journey of a lifetime. Well, I surely couldn't top his Amazon story, as travelers do, though. We talked about where we had gone to other places we had each been. I mentioned I'd recently been in Israel, and this very good dad noted he'd always wanted to go to Israel. He called it the Holy Land, but he felt it would be too dangerous to go there, especially with his kids. Too dangerous to go to Israel after braving the Amazon jungle? I was more than a little stunned. But I explained to him I'd been in Israel just about 6 weeks ago. I lived in Israel for a year and earlier for a summer, visited 12 or 13 times, had taken all three of my children there when they were quite young, and had led Temple Emmanuel trips to Israel with every age of congregant from 6 years old to 80. And I told him I'd walked across most of the city of Jerusalem two late nights in a row a few weeks ago without the least concern for my safety. He was impressed and surprised. But isn't it dangerous? He asked. Well, nowhere near as dangerous as walking across an American city after dark, I said, and I think a whole lot safer than this guy's recent Amazon trip. You know, Israel is nothing like the media reports make it out to be. It's both an entirely modern country and the most breathtaking place to experience history and religion. And I've honestly never felt unsafe there. Oh, he said, I'm glad. I'd love to go and take my kids. Still, it was a really startling illustration of the contrast between reality and perception that challenges us in so many areas of our lives. You know, to watch the media, you would think Israel was a place filled solely with terrorists and brutal military goons who fight them, that the smell of tear gas and explosives is more prominent than the smell of pine trees or flowers. Of course, the opposite is true. Israel is beautiful, ultra-modern, and absolutely ancient both, and traveling there is amazingly fulfilling and safe. One more trip memory this week. While in Istanbul, Turkey, Wendy and I went to the temple Neve Shalom, a synagogue near the Galata Tower. It is a particularly beautiful sanctuary. It is the largest congregation in Turkey, unfortunately made famous by two terrorist attacks some years ago. Finding Neve Shalom was an adventure, although it's a big building, and we knew the address and the location in Istanbul. When we walked through the neighborhood looking for it, we were only able to find it because of the security guards hanging around. We had sent our information on by email ahead of time, and they took copies of our passports when we entered to go to Shabbat morning services, and that was about it for security. The people were very nice. Frankly, nearly everybody in Turkey was very nice to us, as usual. And when we finally got to the sanctuary, we were able to participate in almost the whole service. Well, at least I was. Being an Orthodox Sephardic service, Wendy had to sit upstairs in the women's gallery, but it was pretty up there anyway. They began services very early, at 8 a.m. in the morning or so, as they do in Israel, and finished the whole thing by about 10 a.m. I enjoyed being asked to duchen, to participate in offering the blessings of the Kohanim, the priests from the Bima, and was given the first aliyah to the Torah. In spite of language barriers, we couldn't really communicate fluently, but we managed with some Hebrew and some English and a bit of Ladino and Spanish. My Turkish consists of one phrase, teşekkür ederim. That means thank you, by the way. Anyway, it was a beautiful service, competently led and participated in very fully by the congregation. While most of the prayers, most of the liturgy, was very similar to Sephardic services I've attended elsewhere, as was the Nusach, the musical framework for prayer, there were a couple of prayers given in Ladino, that wonderful mix of Spanish and Hebrew that the Sephardim brought with them from Spain to Turkey back in 1492, when Sultan Bayezid II invited the expelled Jews of Ferdinand and Isabella into his Ottoman Empire. Well, to play us in this morning in that spirit, here's a song from the Sons of Sfarad, the very lovely Adio Querida.
Adio, adio querida, no quiero la vida, me la marcaste tú. Tu madre cuando te parió, y te quitó al mundo, corazón ella no te dio para amar segundo. Corazón ella no te dio para amar segundo. Adiós, adiós querido. No quiero la vida, me la marcaste tú. Adiós, adiós querida. No quiero la vida, me la marcaste tú.
That was Adio Querida from the Sons of Sfarad. So, back to Istanbul's Neve Shalom Synagogue a couple of weeks ago on Shabbat. When we finished with the very lovely and quick service, they invited us downstairs for an excellent full kosher Turkish lunch, preceded by a nice dry wine kiddush and, oh, a shot of Turkish arak, their favorite spirit. They gave us berekas, smoked salmon, wonderful fruits and breads, and delicious semolina pastry. A truly lovely, generous morning. And we completed prayers and Torah reading and lunch, all by about 10:30 in the morning on Shabbat, which gave us the whole rest of the day for touring and enjoying Istanbul. Very, very nice way to spend the Sabbath. I'll fill you in on the ancient synagogue on the Greek island of Delos, home of the most important pagan shrine in antiquity, and of the beauties of a Friday night service at the Great Synagogue of Rome next week on Too Jewish. When we come back in a few moments, we'll meet our guest, the outstanding American Jewish historian Deborah Lipstadt, author of the new book, The Eichmann Trial. She'll tell you things you definitely did not know about that when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of restaurants offer great food and service, but not all restaurants also offer life lessons. For example, learning to share is a lesson that families try to instill in their kids at an early age. At Mama's, we're here to help. For example, order a slice of pepperoni pizza. One hungry person can definitely eat it, but it's pretty huge, which means you could share it with your kid. What a great example you'd be setting. You're sharing something that you love with someone you love. Or get a family-sized calzone. It's really huge. When your family is stuffed, you could share the leftovers with your parents-in-law. It's a generous act that demonstrates your kindness and also might earn you several nights of babysitting. Or order a slice of Mama's delicious cheesecake. The portion is generous, which means... Nah, let's not go overboard with the sharing idea. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics, infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register, arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We're delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Deborah Lipstadt. She's the Dorot Professor of Modern Jewish History and Holocaust Studies at Emory University in Atlanta. She's the author of the new book, The Eichmann Trial, in time for the 50th anniversary of that trial. Also the author of History on Trial, My Day in Court with David Irving, which we'll talk about a little later, the National Jewish Book Award winner, and Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, and Beyond Belief, The American Press and the Coming of the Holocaust, and many, many articles. Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you. Tell me what prompted you to write the Eichmann Trial book.
Well, actually, it wasn't my idea. It's part of a series called the Next Book Series, and the editor of the series, Jonathan Rosen, himself an author, accomplished author, came to me and said, "You're the one to do this book." And I said, "Why me in this book? I mean, I work on the Holocaust, but I wasn't particularly expert in the Eichmann trial or working on the Eichmann trial." And he said, "Well, you went through a trial. You were on trial. Your trial was cited as a significant post-war Holocaust trial. You're the one to write about this trial." And I told him that I thought it was silly to think that because I had gone through a trial, I would have any special insights into the Eichmann trial, that one would be connected to the other. But in certain ways, they were.
Which ways were they connected? It's a really interesting reasoning on his part. I never
right.
would have thought.
Well, and at the center of both legal events was a single man who was a dyed-in-the-wool, committed anti-Semite, who did what he did. In one case, of course, the crimes that they committed, Irving wasn't charged with a crime, he was suing me for libel, were quite different. Adolf Eichmann was responsible for the for the murder of probably close to 1.5 million Jews. David Irving has killed or physically harmed no one. But they both are motivated to do what they do by, or to have done what they did by a deep-seated anti-Semitism. So that certainly was one parallel. I think another parallel was that there are people out there who will try to convince others that this did not happen, who will try to make it sound other than it was. I was just following orders. I didn't really believe it, whatever. And how important it is for historians to be involved in that debate and exposing what the truth is.
You know, in your book, in the Eichmann trial, you talk about Hannah Arendt. Tell us a little bit about what you expected to know about her, because all of us have heard a great deal about her, I would think, and what you found out when you really began to study.
Hannah Arendt was a German Jew born in Germany to a mother from from Russia and a father whose family had long roots in Germany. And she was a brilliant student, studied philosophy with Martin Heidegger. When the Nazis came to power, she escaped to France because...
Might be worth mentioning she was also Heidegger's mistress.
Oh, yes, she had an affair with Heidegger as a young girl, right. She escaped to France because she had been doing some courier work for Zionist organizations in Germany, and she was afraid she might be arrested. She spent a good part of the next of the rest of the decade in France working with Youth Aliyah, the organization that helped take young people to then Palestine. And then when the Germans came to France, she escaped from France to the United States. She had first some menial jobs and some editing jobs and with important publications and publishers, including, ironically, my own, Schocken Books. Hmm. But then she went into academia. She published The Origins of Totalitarianism, which got a tremendously positive review and caused a great deal of interest and discussion. And when the Eichmann trial was announced, she said, I have to be there. So she arranged with the New Yorker for them to send her there to cover the trial. So she writes a report on the trial that first appears as five separate articles in the New Yorker and then as a book. And it's called Eichmann in Jerusalem on the Banality of Evil. And I like to say it's one of the few books that is better known by its subtitle than it's by its title.
It is.
And in it, she argues that Eichmann was not a committed anti-Semite, that he was an automaton, you know, doing what he was told to do, because that, of course, fit in with her theories that she had published in The Origins of Totalitarianism. And also, and this was what really created the controversy, that the leadership in the various ghettos where Jews were to be found compromised, collaborated, made up lists and of who was to be deported, and they were practically as great an enemy to the Jews in the ghettos as were the Nazis. And she was very cruel in how she expressed this, and this caused many, many people to take issue with her.
We will talk much more, not just about Hannah Arendt, but about the Eichmann trial and other issues with historian Deborah Lipstadt. We'll return on To Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com, TOO Jewish Radio, or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear past and present shows through the website, or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center, the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Last week we were talking about the Israeli army, which is kind of the central socializing influence in Israeli life. If in America it's high school or college, and then maybe the military for some people. In Israel, it's the military. Let's talk a little bit about how people get chosen, how they decide what units they're going into. How do they make that decision? It's a big decision.
There is a relatively long filtering process that starts when you reach the age of 16. Includes physical testing as well as other kind of tests that check your intelligence, your skills,
your emotions,
your motivations, your social background, your financial background, or family background, to see that your family is strong enough, that you're strong enough. And of course, what you want is a central part. If you come and say, I want to volunteer for a more prestige unit that has more challenges, it means something about you. You probably have a stronger motivation to go there. After the first phases of filtering, some of the units have a week long of military experience that is extremely physically challenging as well as socially challenging to really test the motivation of participants. And usually this is only for the more prestige units like the Air Force or very high quality units, which have a lot of people that wants to volunteer. And out of thousands, they need to cherry pick very few people to join the unit. And it's very, very challenging to participate and check motivation. Another interesting element that I just remembered about the IDF, and about 3-4 weeks ago, I met a young lady from Israel, and she told me, you know, the IDF, more than it's securing Israel, it's the best J-date in the world. And I must say that you know, that is true. A lot of the people I know met their spouses in the military.
I know somebody who met his spouse in the military.
Well, actually, I did.
Yes, exactly.
I can share with you that my wife was my physical fitness commander at officer school. And after every morning, she was, you know, telling us to run around, do those 5 miles, come back, checking times for us, you're too slow, you need to get better, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the course, I said, okay, we're thousands of men, very few ladies, I need to get her.
Well, and you know, you were already trained as a husband. You did everything she said.
Exactly. You know, and it works still today.
Well, thanks, Guy. Great story. And that's a good shout out to your wife, too. And we will talk much more about the military and other subjects next week. Thanks, Guy.
Okay, thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Weiler of Janos J Bar and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails is a wonderful new place, maybe the best in Arizona.
Well, we just won Best New Restaurant in Tucson.
I heartily concur. What's your favorite stuff on the menu?
There's so many things that we do well downtown. It's really the foods of the entire world. And so at lunch, we do this great pounded Laotian pounded papaya salad. At dinner, have the trout. Trout with oysters and cream corn. Late night, you got to have the downtown burger.
And you can hear great music there late night too, can't you?
You don't have to go to bed early. You can stay up late Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, listen to live jazz, great specials on the late night menu, great drinks, incredible cocktails we make there, by the way. It's in the name.
I have to say, try the Game Changer Soup, too. What's the phone number for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
623-7700.
Or it's www.downtownkitchen.com.
That's it.
We'll see you there, Janos.
Thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Recently back from an interesting trip to France and some interesting parts of France.
Right. We were in the southern end of the Rhone Valley on a University of Arizona Alumni Association trip. I want to come at this a slightly different way, which is that one of my former students, one of the brightest students I ever had, has now been working for just over a year as a Peace Corps volunteer in a small town in Ukraine. And he wrote an email to me expressing some surprise at what a big deal May 8th is in the former Soviet Union, and particularly in Ukraine. May 8th being VE Day, although there it's called Victory Day. And most Ukrainian kids don't even know that the United States participated in any way in World War II. Of course, proportionally, the Russians lost far more than we did. But I always remind my students that VE Day is hugely celebrated throughout Europe, where there's a keener consciousness of history, generally speaking, than there is in the U.S., and where people are frequently reminded of both World War I and World War II by virtue of memorials or monuments to all the people of that particular town or village who died in the war. And unless it's a really big city, virtually everybody has an uncle or a grandfather or a cousin or somebody from their family who died in the war, either World War I or World War II. And so it's a very personal thing that took place in their backyard. In this context, more and more towns in France have started to create, over the past decade, memorials or monuments in a very appropriate, dignified way to Jews who were deported by the Nazis during the occupation. And they don't mention or make any judgment on the French role, the degree to which the French were either complicit or resistant to this process. But, you know, in a little corner of Avignon, right opposite the synagogue, is a, it's now called Place Jérusalem, which it wasn't called historically. And there's a very tasteful memorial to the Jews who were deported. And in Marseille, there is a huge, a plinth that's literally like 30 feet tall, engraved to the memory and honor of Jews who were deported during World War II. So there's an increasing number of places at which Jews can pay their respects to the Jews of France who were deported and were victims of World War II in one way or another, which weren't there when I lived in France all those years ago.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think that that consciousness in France has increased dramatically. And actually, I'm not sure it has any relationship to Sarkozy's ability to sort of bring some of that Holocaust issues to the fore, but he's done so as well.
Well, it was also, I think, a result of some of the trials of war criminals in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
The Pepin trial, a lot of trials, which have brought this to the forefront of French consciousness and which have caused quite important space, public spaces in many cities to be dedicated to the memory of Holocaust victims.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. The psychiatrist asked the Jewish man lying on his couch, "So, besides suffering, what other hobbies do you have?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a very brief special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Today we're talking about Moses' magic staff. You might say, to be fable-ish about it, Moses had a little stick, well, maybe a big stick, and it had all kinds of magical powers. In truth, in the Torah, it really is a mysterious object, this staff. When he carries it in the wilderness of Sinai as a young shepherd, it's just a wooden stick. And Moses learns from God in the burning bush episode, it will turn into a snake if he throws it on the ground. And then when he does it before Pharaoh, it turns out that Pharaoh's magicians can work the same trick, but Moses' snake stick actually swallows their snake sticks. That same mateh, the stick, is used by Moses under God's direction to part the Sea of Reeds to allow the Israelites to cross. It's then lowered to drown their Egyptian pursuers. It's used to strike the rock and bring water to thirsty tribes, and it's held up in Moses' hand to help the Israelites triumph over their enemies in war. But in truth, this magical staff of Moses is really just a stick. Its effectiveness is based solely on what God enables it to do. Which brings us to this week's Torah portion of Matot. The name comes from one of the two words used in the Torah for a tribe of Israel, mateh, which means rod or stick. The other word, shevet, means branch. Both are really references to the staffs used to designate officials who led the people. Branches of Moses' own staff of authority, if you will. As we come towards the conclusion of the book of Numbers, which means nearly the end of the actual narrative of the journeys of the Israelites through the wilderness to the borders of the Promised Land, Moses is instructed by God to have the Israelites make a census of the tribes, a new count for those who are to enter Israel and make it their homeland. In Matot, the tribes are arranged, a census is taken according to their staffs, like Moses' own staff, his mateh. In effect, they're counted by their sticks. But like Moses' magic staff, their importance, their relevance, their effectiveness is based entirely on how God chooses to use them. In essence, the lesson is that our sacred power, our magic, if you will, derives solely from God. We are all, in our own way, instruments of the divine will. We count in this world when we serve God. When we come back on To Jewish with the terrific historian Deborah Lipstadt, author of the Eichmann Trial, she will also tell us what it's like to be sued by a neo-Nazi in England and how it feels to defend the truth. All that when we return on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A new Israeli law penalizing anyone who targets Israel or West Bank settlements for boycott has united American Jewish organizations against this measure, who call it an affront to the freedom of expression. "We're disappointed the Knesset passed the law," said Rabbi Steve Guto, director of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the umbrella body for Jewish public policy groups, oh, and a former guest of Two Jewish, of course. "We don't support boycotts," Guto said, adding the law does challenge democracy in a way, and hopefully the Supreme Court in Israel will respond. The Knesset enacted the law late last Monday night by a vote of 47-38 after hours of fierce debate. The legislation was initiated by Likud Knesset member Zev Elkin. It allows advocates of boycotts against Israel or areas under its control to be sued for monetary damages by those who are hurt by the boycotts. It also prohibits the Israeli government from doing business with companies that comply with the boycotts. A number of liberal Israeli NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and civil rights groups are mounting legal challenges to this law. In America, a negative feeling towards the measure seems to span the ideological spectrum, from J Street on the left to the Zionist Organization of America on the right. Mort Klein, the ZOA's president, said he was still examining the law, but that in principle, the ZOA opposed anti-boycott laws. Nobody's more appalled by the boycott of Ariel Theater than me, but to make it illegal? I don't think so, Klein said, referring to calls by some Israeli artists to boycott a performing arts center in the West Bank settlement of Ariel. Supporters of the law in Israel say it is a necessary countermeasure to boycott efforts. But the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, says in a public statement that the legislation is not the right way to fight boycotts. To legally stifle calls to action, however abhorrent and detrimental they might be, is a disservice to Israeli society, said Abe Foxman, the ADL's national director, and another former Two Jewish guest. We hope Israel's Supreme Court will quickly take up a review of this law and resolve the concerns it raises. We join with almost all of American Judaism in hoping that the Knesset, or perhaps the Israeli Supreme Court, will quickly reverse this unfortunate bill. And we have two fascinating eulogies this week.
Smile without a reason why. Love as if you were a child. Smile, no matter what they tell you. Don't listen to a word they say, 'cause life is beautiful that way. Tears, a tidal wave of tears. Light that slowly disappears. There's still another game to play, and life is beautiful that way.
Italian Holocaust survivor Rubino Romeo Salmoni, whose memoir of surviving Auschwitz inspired the fantastic film Life is Beautiful, died July 10th at Rome at the age of 91. His book, In the End, I Beat Hitler, used flashes of irony and dark humor to describe conditions in Auschwitz, where he was sent. Salmoni told his story often in public, including during visits to schools and colleges, determined the Holocaust should not be soon forgotten. He said he viewed his survival as a triumph over the Nazis. "I'm still here, hale and hearty," he said. "I came out of Auschwitz alive. I have a wonderful family. I celebrated my golden wedding anniversary. I have 12 splendid grandchildren. I think I can say I ruined Hitler's plan for me." Rome Mayor Johnny Alemano said Salmoni was a great man who, with his courage and determination, managed to save himself from the hell of Auschwitz-Birkenau. Romeo was an example for young people and for the whole of Rome. Life is Beautiful, which starred and was directed by the Italian comedian Roberto Benigni, was inspired by Salmoni's story, but Benigni invented the fanciful tale of a father shielding his son from knowledge of the concentration camp in which they were held. Life is Beautiful won the Cannes Film Festival Grand Prize and the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar in 1999, and Benigni won Best Actor, as he should have. Salmoni, a native of Rome, was arrested by the Italian fascist police in 1944, held in a Roman prison, transferred to an Italian internment camp at Fossoli near Modena in northern Italy, and was a forced laborer in Auschwitz until the camp was liberated in 1945. 7,500 Italian Jews were murdered by the Nazis during World War II.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship.
Sherwood Schwartz, the creator of two of the iconic television shows in history, both Gilligan's Island and The Brady Bunch, died this past week. Schwartz was born in Passaic, New York in 1916, got a BA from NYU, and then came out to LA to go to USC and become a nice Jewish doctor. He was working on his master's in biology in 1939 when he suddenly gave up his medical plans. You see, his older brother Al was writing for the first year of the Bob Hope Show on radio, and Sherwood needed money, so he asked his brother if he could write a few jokes for Bob Hope. The jokes worked, Hope used them in his show, and invited him to write for the show regularly. He stayed with Bob Hope for about 4 years. After going into the Army during World War II, he wrote for Armed Forces Radio, including such shows as Mail Call and Jubilee. Schwartz went back to radio work, writing for the radio version of The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. He moved then to a new media, television, writing for, among other shows, one of my personal favorites, My Favorite Martian, to be exact. And then he was the head writer on the Red Skelton Show for 7 years, for which he won an Emmy in 1961. He and Red Skelton had a challenging relationship. In his contract as head writer, Sherwood had it included that he did not need to meet with Skelton face to face, ever. As an escape from the stress of working for Red Skelton, Sherwood Schwartz dreamed up the ultimate escapist show in 1964, Gilligan's Island. There was nothing quite as escapist as the wacky tale of seven people on a small charter boat, the SS Minnow, who went out on their three-hour tour and wound up shipwrecked on an uncharted South Pacific island. Starring Bob Denver in the title role of the boat's bumbling crew member, Gilligan's Island featured the exasperated skipper Alan Hale Jr., the millionaire and his wife Jim Backus and Natalie Schaefer, the professor Russell Johnson, that's a good trivia question, the naive country girl Dawn Wells, and the sexy movie star Tina Louise. And Schwartz wrote the lyrics for the show's memorable theme song.
The mate was a mighty sailing man,
the skipper brave and sure.
5 passengers set sail that day
for a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour.
When it debuted, critics had a field day lambasting Schwartz's shipwreck saga. It is impossible that a more inept, moronic, or humorless show has ever appeared on the home tube, wrote UPI. It is difficult for me to believe that Gilligan's Island was written, directed, and filmed by adults, wrote Terrence O'Flaherty from the San Francisco Chronicle. And Jack Gold of the New York Times added, it is quite possibly the most preposterous situation comedy of the season. But the show's very preposterousness struck a chord with millions and millions of viewers, and still does. Endless renditions of that song, barroom debates about Ginger or Mary Ann, and many, many reruns. For all its crude sight gags, lowbrow humor, and pratfalls, Schwartz viewed Gilligan's Island as something more. It is, he said, my version of a social microcosm where seven people from various backgrounds had to learn to live together. In a TV Guide interview back in 65, Schwartz said he was not disheartened by the negative reviews, only a bit angry with a lack of understanding of what was being attempted. Here are the same men who forever say, for heaven's sake, won't somebody give us something other than the wife, the husband, and 2 children? And 4 years later, as a kind of ironic twist, Schwartz served up his own version of that television staple, the family sitcom.
Here's the story of a lovely lady. Bringing up 3 very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold, like their mother, the youngest one in curl.
The story of the marriage between the lovely lady with 3 daughters and a man named Brady with 3 sons, the Brady Bunch became TV's first sitcom to feature a blended family. And its theme song again had lyrics written by, you guessed it, Mr. Schwartz. Like Gilligan's Island, The Brady Bunch was dismissed by critics, and it never did quite as well as Schwartz's Gang of Castaways in the ratings, but the idyllic suburban tale of Marcia, Jan, Cindy, Greg, Peter, Bobby, Mike, Carol, and Alice the Housekeeper took on a life of its own in endless syndicated reruns around the world, watched by many, many generations. It became another essential part of popular American culture, spinning off other TV series, several films, stage productions, and many, many lunchboxes and toy sets. Sherwood Schwartz, who practically made a career out of these 2 shows, put little stock in what critics had to say about his creations. I honestly think I could sit down and write a show tonight that the critics would love. And I know it would be canceled within 4 weeks, Schwartz said in an interview with The Times. I know what the critics love. We write and produce for people, not for critics. As one writer put it, thanks, Mr. Schwartz, for making a happier childhood. By the way, one of his sons did eventually become a nice Jewish doctor. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Deborah Lipstadt. She's the Dorot Professor of Modern Jewish History and the Holocaust Studies at Emory University, the author of the new book, The Eichmann Trial, and several other books about the Holocaust, including a book about the trial in which she faced down David Irving, the Holocaust denier in England. Before we come back to the Eichmann Trial book, many of our listeners, I think, are familiar with some aspects of the case, but with a little bit more perspective on it, tell us a little bit about how that trial with Irving has affected your work since then.
It made me look and understand the importance of trials in a way that I hadn't really understood before. I think it gave me I always felt that the courtroom was no place for history. History didn't belong in the courtroom. And I still believe that. I would never, you know, sue someone on a historical issue and take them into the courtroom. But that history can function very well in the courtroom. And it did. In both cases, the wrongdoings of these men were exposed. Irving's wrongdoing was mangling history and lying about history and doing nefarious things with history. And Eichmann's, of course, wrongdoing was taking away the life of many, many people.
It's quite different, but, people may not remember, but in the Irving trial, you were actually a defendant initially.
That's
correct?
Right. I was sued for libel by David Irving in Britain, and the reason he chose to do it in Britain was there the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove the truth of what she says and not on the plaintiff to prove the falsehood, as it would be in the United States. So in England, if I say something and someone sues me for libel, I have to prove it was the truth. And it was this that had a big part in, sort of shaping my decision to fight back, because had I not fought back, he would have won by default because I would have put up no defense. And I just couldn't see that happening, and that was one of the reasons why I chose to fight so vigorously against him.
Essentially being sued for libel by David Irving, you know, that very concept, it's like being sued for falsehood by Richard Nixon, you know. It's
I hear you and absolutely agree with you. I think that David Irving thought I wouldn't fight back, that I would just stand to the side, that I would just pay him the £500 he wanted and agree to have my book destroyed and leave it at that. And there was a journalist who after the trial said, well, Irving's big mistake was picking on the wrong person.
One of the really fascinating parts about your book is where you explore the debate held in Israel about whether Eichmann should get the death penalty.
That was a major debate. I mean, Israel did not have the death penalty, does not have the death penalty, except for this particular law for Nazis and their collaborators. And no one had ever been sentenced to the death penalty. And there were many people who felt that Eichmann should be forced to live out his life in Israel. In fact, there was even someone who suggested that Eichmann should be forced to travel the length and breadth of Israel. And see what he said. That would be the worst punishment for him. Not to convince him, you know, that his anti-Semitism was wrong, but to show him that we are still here. He didn't accomplish what he thought he would accomplish.
You know, there's an almost surreal scene there where Martin Buber wants to meet with David Ben-Gurion.
The famous philosopher Martin Buber, the Hebrew University professor, the German educator, the world-respected scholar.
The author of I and Thou.
Right, exactly. Was in a study group with Ben-Gurion. And he approached Ben-Gurion and he said, I'd like to talk to you about the sentence for Eichmann. And I'd like to come to your office and see you. And Ben-Gurion said, he was 80. Buber was 82, and I don't know, Ben-Gurion was 74 or something at that point. And Ben-Gurion said, you're older, I'll come to you. So Ben-Gurion went to Buber's house, and they sat, and they spoke for over an hour. And Buber, in fact, quoted to him from Hasidic masters about the importance of life, et cetera, et cetera. And in the end, did not convince Ben-Gurion to suggest to the president of the state that the death sentence be abrogated.
It's an amazing story, only in Israel. In the Eichmann, the Eichmann trial was considered, of course, by, you know, Eichmann had been captured by Israeli secret agents and brought to Israel from Argentina. It was controversial. It was controversial at the time in the world, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very controversial. Look, it was rightfully controversial. Israel went into a foreign country and went after someone he considered it a someone who had broken its laws and done something wrong. In fact, broken you know, international law, and kidnapped him and brought him to Israel. And there was a great deal of debate about it. There were those who said, look, nobody else was looking for him. Nobody else was willing to try him. Argentina knew he was there, but didn't do anything about it, et cetera, et cetera. And others who said, you know, this is wrong. You can't do this. Some people said that Israel didn't exist when these crimes were created, were committed. So how could it have claim authority? And others said, wait a minute, the greatest number of people who were directly affected by the crimes of the Holocaust live in Israel. So to say that Israel didn't exist, or that this is ex post facto judgment, is just silly. It's no more ex post facto judgment than Nuremberg was ex post, the trials at Nuremberg were ex post facto judgment. And Israel just, the truth of the matter is nobody else was interested in trying him. The Germans certainly, everyone said, well, he should be tried in Germany. The last thing Germany wanted was to have a trial there. They actually had no interest in having a trial there. The Argentinians were not interested in trying him. There was no international court to conduct the trial. There was an international court, but only heard cases between nations. So all these things came into play, and Israel wasn't going to, even if some of these other situations had been different, Israel was not about to turn him over.
One of the other really interesting and weird sidelights of the whole Eichmann story was his offer to sell Jews in exchange for petrol or trucks during the war. Was that known before the trial?
Yes. There were people who knew about it, but not in the detail that it was known as a result of the trial. It was not a secret. People knew about it. But many more people learned about it as a result of the trial.
You know, historians aren't necessarily supposed to conclude, but now having spent, you know, a good deal of time and effort exploring the Eichmann trial, how do you think Israel did on the Eichmann trial?
I think it, by and large, it did pretty well. Was the trial perfect? No. Was it fair? It was fair-ish. You know, Eichmann's lawyers were outgunned. There were witnesses he couldn't call because had they come into the state of Israel, Israel might have arrested them for the crimes they committed. There was a judge sitting on the bench who had declared Eichmann the devil in another case. You know, when one of the Jews who was negotiating with him in Hungary was suing someone for libel, this judge had said about this man, he sold his soul to the devil, and the devil was Eichmann. So there were many things about the trial that raised questions about it, but on the whole, I think it was a very important event and a reminder to the world, maybe to bring this together on a sort of contemporary note. You know, Mladic was recently captured. Another Yemeni alleged terrorist was captured. There's a debate in our country about trials in Guantanamo or trials on the United States or whether to have trials at all. And I think we have to remember that, that trials can work, and they do often work. Do bring punishment, and they do expose the wrongs that have been done. So I think maybe that's a thing to keep in mind.
It is. I want to thank Deborah Lipstadt for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book is called The Eichmann Trial. It's available, like everything, at Amazon and everywhere else books are sold. Deborah, thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Shalom Friedman, the fine Israeli poet and author. Our playout this morning comes from the Jews of the Aegean Sea, from whence I have just returned over the wine dark sea. It's called En el Camino de la Scola, and it's from the Voice of the Turtle Group CD, Under Aegean Moons. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
En el camino de la escuela, con un mancebo me encontré. Bonjour, le di, le abrí la mano, yo le apreté. Bonjour, le di, le abrí la mano, yo le apreté.
Bonjour, te doy en primero, por hablar de lo que quiero. Esperanza en ti tengo. Por entero, esperanza.